Hello and welcome to the Green Business Podcast, a show about climate entrepreneurs and their exciting businesses. I am your host Bharti for these conversations about scaling up a climate-driven business. My guest today is Laksh Arora from Desi Hangover that offers sustainable, incredibly comfortable and stylish shoes under the brand Desi. Desis are handcrafted and they are reinventing traditional Indian footwear such as mojris, jutis and making it appealing to today's customer. Laksha, along with his friends Hitesh and Abha, started the company in 2014. They offer more than 50 product designs now. Desis are sold through online channels as well as offline stores across India, US, Malaysia and Singapore. The company currently has a team of 15 full-time members and also works with 150 artisans who create these shoes. They were recently seed funded by Social Alpha and CIE. Hi Laksh, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much Bharti for this. I've been listening to your podcast. It's been great. Glad to be here.
Yeah, wonderful. And let's start with your origin story. Please talk to us about what got you interested in creating ethnic footwear.
Okay, so it goes back to 2013. So at that time, me and one of my co-founders, so we are three co-founders in all, it's Abha, Hitesh and myself. So Hitesh and I were working in an organization called ISEC while still in college. So at that time, we happened to visit Egypt on an internship slash exchange, and we were there for about 45 days, Jan of 2013. Now there, we had a pair of Kolhapuri chappal, and we were living with interns from about 25 different countries.
Okay.
Now, these interns really loved that pair, okay? And we were like, okay, like there is something that we are not able to figure out, but these guys are able to, you know, sort of get it. And there itself, we thought, let's do something with this. Let's go back to India, figure out where these products are made, and let's start a business with it. Came back to India. Abha was a two-year college senior to Hitesh, and she had just graduated and joined in as a lecturer in the same college. So, and she had a design bent. So she looked at it and, you know, together we started talking, and then, you know, she joined in, she left her job, she joined us full time in 2014, and we incorporated the company and we started exploring the artisans, the villages where these shoes are made, and then eventually stumbled upon the village where we now work, figured out what's the craft, and, you know, like it was really not about the footwear, but the entire process, that how beautifully a footwear can be made. And we were always like that, hey, if an Italian shoe can get a place where what it has in the world, why not an Indian shoe? Why not these Indian artisans, you know, be at the same level? And that was the motivation. And hence we started the business.
So from the time that you made your first shoe to today, talk to us about how the journey has been, where you are now, and what does Desi stand for?
Got it. So we started, as I told, we incorporated in 2014. Sorry, we started with two artisans. Now these two artisans still work with us, and we, you know, like created the first pair. Now this pair was already existing with the artisans, so there was not a lot of innovation in the design. But we realized that there needs to be a lot of innovation in the product itself, right? Like it starts right from the quality of the material to the comfort level. So we started taking a lot of customer feedback and we started evolving that product. That product is called Hola. It's still one of our best sellers. Now Hola, we evolved from a regular worn down shoe that would, you know, like with very basic quality into something of great quality, keeping the craft intact. Added features. Now we have, you know, patent for a foot locker, because we realized early in the journey that there are certain reasons because of which people do not buy a handcrafted pair of shoes, or there is not a price point that the artisans can make back their money. And the reason for that was the comfort level is low. There is no uniformity in sizing. There is no quality of material that is comparable to what you can get, say, in a Hush Puppy or, you know, in any other evolved business. So we solved step by step all of those problems and made products which could be, you know, worn, made in like India, made in a village in India, but could be worn in Times Square and people could rejoice at, rather love to talk about it. So that is what we did, and we've been evolving those products. Abha, who's my co-founder, she manages the entire design team, so she's been pretty instrumental in, you know, getting all of that out. Of course, we have designers from Nift now which work in that team. So we are a very product focused and artisan focused business. So we kept the craft in that, created these products, and the next challenge was that getting it out to the audiences. So we, and like any small business, we started with creating a Facebook page, then we created our website, then we started doing exhibitions. Like our first exhibition was in Bangalore called Sunday Soul Sante. Then we did like innumerable exhibitions in India across the next year. Because of our Facebook ads, we got our first client in Malaysia who reached out to us and said that, hey, let's start doing business. It's been 5 years. It's been about 7 years now. We're still working with him. And then small retailers started approaching. We started approaching a bunch of them, and the distribution channel eventually spread out to today when we are available at 150 plus Fabrinia stores in India. Proudly the only brand which sells by its own brand name in Fabrinia. So we have a co-branded deal with them. We will soon be launching in Metro Shoes stores across 3 states. And we have a strong digital footprint across India. And we are developing markets in Singapore and the US right now. So that is how, you know, the business has evolved. From 2 artisans, we have about 150 plus artisans. Still the 3 co-founders, about a team of 15 people in Mumbai. So yeah, that's how the spread of the business has grown.
Wonderful. And what does Desi stand for? Is it an ethnic show for all the occasion? And who is it for? Is it for millennials or is it for everyone?
Right. So I'll just like take a step back and tell about the name. So it's Desi Hangover. now a lot of people ask us that why the hangover? It was, we were 18 and 19 respectively when we started, right? So one thought in our head was like, get over the colonial hangover. Why an English brand would sell you? So Desi Hangover, that's a story. Now, who is the shoe for? It's for honestly anyone, not just in India, but globally. Anyone who wears a summer shoe, anyone who wears a boat shoe. So we are basically creating a very distinctive category of shoes. Now, one problem with, like, for example, in India, right? Like one problem with ethnic shoes is that you wear an ethnic shoe and you just wear it for one occasion and you leave it away. Our shoes can be worn on an ethnic occasion, but at the same time, the same pair of shoes is pretty suitable to be worn on a pair of chinos or on a pair of denim. So the lifetime of the shoe is pretty big. So we cater to audiences between 25 to 45 years of age. And these people are, 50% of our audience is tier 2, tier 3, 50% is tier 1. So these are the people who use Apple devices. You would stumble upon them going to Starbucks. These are also the people who just enjoy wearing something different. So they are sort of ahead of the curve in fashion to anyone who goes to a regional retailer. So literally our audience is insanely big, right? Like, because it's for anyone and everyone in India, as long as they understand the craft or they are comfortable in their own fashion sense. So, and that's the kind of audiences that we are there with.
Okay. So this kind of audience is spoiled for choice. You know, the kind of audience you mentioned, there are a lot of online and offline brands, especially all the D2C brands, they are trying to target the same audience, right? So what are you doing? What are you doing to ensure that this audience remembers you and keeps coming back?
I would say like it's just product and product for the first sale, because as soon as people see our designs are pretty unique. So we've carved out a very unique niche out there. Along with that, the kind of engineering that has gone into the shoes, right? Like patented back soles, then having like extremely comfortable insoles. So because of all of this engineering and technology, people prefer buying our shoes, you know, over other businesses. There are a lot of businesses who are doing great work, but there's very little innovation that's going into the products. So that's step one. We are sort of like trying to make Apple of, handcrafted leather shoes in India. So that's what we're trying to do. So now that is step one. So it's the product. And the second part is that once the customers get the product, they start appreciating it. And when they read the story further that, okay, an artisan made this shoe and how the artisans are being benefited. So that sort of prompts customer loyalty and advocacy for us. So that's how the entire, you know, chain works out. But it definitely has to be the product, and it has worked really well for us.
Okay, wonderful. And I now want to talk about the sustainability aspects of this. So desis are leather shoes made from animal skins. Right. And animals are a big, large source of greenhouse emissions. So can you talk about how you are making desis sustainable?
Sure. So the way our shoes are made, so we use two kinds of leathers. So for the midsoles, we use VT or vegetable tan leather. Now this leather particularly comes around from the tanneries around the village where we make it. So these are like legacy tanneries run by artisans. Now within these tanneries, the way it works out is that they take skins of animals who die naturally. They dye them out with turmeric and bark. It's a very, very tedious and a long process. So there's very little emission in terms of the carbon emission from, you know, like procuring and, you know, getting a young animal killed, because we really, really do not believe in that. So it is actually sourced from there, and nor do we believe in a lot of chemicals. Hence, you know, like the entire tanning is done by turmeric and bark. The rest of the leather comes from LWG certified leather tanneries in India. So LWG is a certification that the government provides because there is strong audit in where the leather is coming from. And this is basically sourced from as a byproduct of the meat industry. And there is limited to no chemicals used in the production of it. So that is why how we ensure the sustainability of the upper material. However, for the outsoles, we use TPR thermoplastic rubber, which is again a culmination of rubber and plastic, which is upcycled to basically create these soles. Having said that, we are not married to the material as much as we are to the craft. So we are actively looking for alternative plant-based materials, but we are very, very anti the petroleum-based fog leather, and you know, because they just harm the environment way more than any other material. Which makes them like supremely unsustainable. But we are pretty actively looking at other plant-based fibers, and hopefully in the next 12 months we will have some plant-based fiber shoes out, as long as we find something which has the correct tensile strength and the price availability.
Got it. So to begin with, you say that you're sourcing the dead animals, the leather of dead animals, which would otherwise go to landfill or something like that, and other materials are also sustainable. Now tell me that what are the economic impacts of using sustainable materials? So does that mean that the shoe has to be, the processing is expensive vis-a-vis a normal shoe? And what does that mean for you, using sustainable material?
So basically, see, the price point is higher, of course. So it starts right at the point wherein, you know, you have higher price points for the raw material, which is like 30 to 40% higher than any regular non-sustainable material that you'll go for, right? So that is where the cost adds up. But the good part in the entire process is that customers are ready to, you know, pay a little bit of a premium if they are getting the right product and the right quality material. So it really doesn't affect the entire chain. Of course, it does place the products in a slightly premium category, because of course the final price point does demand that kind of a price to be able to, you know, ensure that artisans are paid well, the material is sustainable, and also customers are getting the kind of service that they get with our brand today. So so that's what I would say, but the implication is not that high. However, the material cost is, as I said, 30 to 40% higher than a non-sustainable material cost.
Good, and then you are able to handle it because it is positioned as a, you know, as a special shoe that is handcrafted and that stands for good quality.
Correct. And I think in not just globally but also in India, there is enough awareness now that the audiences care for the material and care for you know, what is going on their body and where is it coming from, who is getting benefited by it, and if they find that the chain is clear and they find transparency, they are ready to pay a price for it, which is great, because that is what is letting businesses like us thrive, right?
Now this is a premium handcrafted shoe being sold offline as well as online. So how does a D2C brand like yours get that experience right, selling a premium shoe online?
Right. So see, we realized it about 3 to 4 years back that it has to be an omni-channel journey. It can't just be digital only or physical only. So hence, you know, like we try to provide that kind of an experience to our customers. When selling online, to answer your question, there's a lot of trust buildup that needs to happen. So, you know, like we have to move away from features. We, like a lot of the D2C business, including us in the initial days, would talk about features. That, hey, our shoe has a patented something which avoids something else, right? Like you would talk, and that is how customers would process it. Like there is something which does something, okay, but how do I care? So we have tried to tell our customers about how does a particular thing benefit, right? So we tell them that, hey, there is a patented footlocker counter which basically helps you prevent any kind of shoe bite. So if you buy our shoe, you would not get a shoe bite. That's why you should buy it. If you wear it for 8 hours, your feet would not pain because we have ensured the comfort in our insoles as well as the outsoles. That's why you should buy it. Our material is resilient enough that for the next 1 year, we would give you a warranty and you can actually, you know, wear it as much as you want. So that's where the trust comes into the picture, right? So it's about communicating all of these aspects at the different levels of the funnel to the customer. So because the first time the customer looks at the shoe, they just like the design, then they come to our website. When they come to our website, it's basically telling them about all these features. Then the next set of confusion comes, okay, where do I wear it? So basically giving them that opportunity to realize, okay, these are the places where you can wear it. Then the next question comes in that, hey, what if it doesn't fit me? So telling them that, hey, if it doesn't fit you, we exchange it without any questions asked. If you want to return it, we return it without any questions asked. So that is the next step to it. And finally, the point comes that, hey, I still don't trust you. Can I pay on delivery? Then we're like, of course you can pay on delivery, like this COD, right? So it's basically making that story for the customer and then just replicating that experience across different cohorts of customers, right? This is just one cohort of customers expecting it. There's another one who just loves something and impulsively buys it. So it's just different cohorts and just giving them that personalized experience and also having humans on the other side, because a chatbot cannot do everything. It does help you scale, but after a certain point, if a customer is really concerned, you have to have humans on the other side, and we ensure that we also have that sorted. So that, you know, entire process makes sure that there is enough good experience and we are able to sell affordable luxury kind of a product online.
Talking more about your go-to-market strategy, you have many celebrity clients, you know, Sonam Kapoor, Kiran Rao, yet I don't see you use influencer marketing, right? So was this a conscious decision to not use these influencers to promote your brand?
Right. So, I mean, like, we are just really lucky that people like Kiran Rao, Sonam Kapoor, and, you know, Omkar, or taking Vishal Daglani, these people have got our shoes, or even Kapil Sharma in one of the shoes, and owned them as well, right? So, of course, we were not at a stage where we could afford to pay them to do it, but they loved the product, so they wore it, and also it was different. But coming at other influencers, which are like in a growth stage, honestly, we worked with influencers and done one-off campaigns. That has not really worked well with us. But now what we are trying to do is we are trying to onboard about 10 influencers onto with us for a year-long thing, wherein we would, and we are trying to recognize influencers who believe in the same cause as we do, which is like they believe in India, they believe in, you know, the Indian craft and how we are enabling Indian artisans to make globally loved products. So people who sort of believe in the same cause and the same values, partnering with them and doing something which is long term, wherein we benefit as well as they benefit, and together we are able to reach out to a much larger audience space. So it's still a work in progress. I would not say we've ruled out that particular thing, but what the way we've approached it in the past has not really worked. So hopefully the way we are trying to work it out now, that should give us better results.
And let's now talk about scaling up. So last 8 years, you have progressed so much. Now you have you have partnership with Fab India, you are selling in multiple countries. So what was the process of scaling like? What all did you have to put in place before you could do all of this? Talk about both sides, marketing, as you know, the generating demand as well as scaling production.
Right. So I think honestly, scaling production is the easier battle to win. A little bit difficult in our case, because we had to establish the first model, but once that was done, it's basically generating supplies we've realized is easier than generating demand, because you have the money to invest in the infrastructure, right? So in terms of demand side, I think we've grown pretty organically for the past 6 years, because we were totally non-funded, so we were bootstrapped. So it's went from exhibition to exhibition, to our website, to getting some distribution clients, to getting about 35 regional retail stores across India. And it was like a tedious, slow process that went across the years, and, you know, maintaining those clients and getting that relationship out. Then once that distribution channel was set, releasing products at the right pace, getting the right information from the market that, hey, these are the colors that will be in demand, these will be the designs which will be in demand, and then getting all of that to the market. So that basically helped us increase the demand of the products, right? At the same time, what we were doing on the supply side, so one of our very close friends and now who's the CEO of our company, Sanket. So he really, you know, worked ground up with the artisans to make that structure. So we have something called as a hub and spoke model. Now in that hub and spoke model, basically we curate artisans in a way that the entire supply chain starts becoming much more efficient. So the same artisans who would produce like 500 pairs a month earlier before DHS intervention can now do about 6 times the same production. So they can now produce about 3,000 pairs, and rather the quality of those products has gone up. So that we've achieved by our hub and spoke model and the training that we provide to artisans. In these years, we've sort of created an informal IP. And now we are pretty confident to be able to multiply that into any other production unit or any other product category that we go into. And just to add one last point, the village where we work, so there are about 1,000 artisan families, right? And we work with about 150 of them. So we still have about 6 times the production scale just by the artisan skill level that we can achieve in the same the village and the craft cluster area. And like, there's no dearth of skill, honestly. As long as there is demand, artisans are ready to learn, artisans are ready to, you know, even come back. So we've seen cases wherein artisans who had left the village joined in as laborers in, you know, Bangalore, etc., because they thought there's no scope of craft, have actually come back after 3 years of staying out and joined Desi Hangover. Because they believe that, you know, like, we are doing something great, we are evolving the craft. And these are young folks. These are like 24, 25, 26 year old chaps, you know, who've come back. So there's enough manpower, and we have established a strong system now to scale up our production as well.
And now that you have funding, Laksh, this should be much easier. The next set of growth should be easier, right?
Yeah, I think we've been very, very lucky with our investors, especially Social Alpha. I think they've been extremely supportive, and not just, helping us scale, but also just being mentors in the sense that how overall holistically we can grow business and how we as founders can grow as well. So that aspect, and of course the money that came in with the investment, has really helped us, you know, close clients like Metro Shoes, and do international campaigns. Like, we did a successful Kickstarter campaign in the US, and now we are opening up more doors within India, as well as expanding to another website for Southeast Asia. So, you know, overall this entire investment has really helped us align and just have more confidence in the entire thing as well, because when an external validation and a belief comes in from an investor's point of view, you know that, you know, like, you can run faster and there are people backing you. So it has definitely been great, and we hope to double our revenues this year and follow up on the same trajectory in the following years as well.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Laksh. Thank you so much for your time in this lovely conversation.
Thank you so much, Bharti. It was great.
Thank you for listening to the Green Business Podcast. This show is brought to you by Finetrain, an advisory firm that supports green businesses in fundraising. You can read more on us on finetrain.com. Thanks again, and see you next time.